I'm Sabrina, I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I want to thank Brooke so much for asking me to do this. It's a complete honor and a privilege to be asked to share at Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, Mickey G, for a beautiful talk. And I wish you guys a wonderful convention. Tomorrow, August 4th, I will have 20 years of sobriety, so. Thanks, and I can't think of a better way to celebrate than sharing with you guys. And it's just such a neat coincidence that Brooke called me not knowing that and asked to do that. It's just, you know, evidence of my higher power today and a beautiful way to celebrate my birthday. So thanks. And I'm going to share with you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. My story actually begins with my father's story. He was an alcoholic and a really bad alcoholic. So my earliest recollections of alcohol are bad ones, you know. And my dad was a real Jekyll and Hyde, fall down kind of drunk. And I had judgment about alcohol. I had a moral opinion about alcohol before I ever ingested alcohol. And a hatred for it, you know. And a real, even from an early age, a feeling, you know, like of wanting God to intervene. We used to go to Sunday school when we were kids, and I believed in the God I heard in Sunday school, you know, heard about in Sunday school, and I perceived that God as my friend and somebody who would help me. And my dad would work nights, and he'd come home midnight, 1, 2 in the morning, and I would hear him drunk, and I would pray to that God, you know, please get my dad sober, please help my dad stop drinking. You know, I was just so earnest about it. And my dad did not stop drinking right then. But, you know, I just had such an opinion about alcohol, and I would have sworn to you at the age 7, 8, 9, because of my shame and my judgment and everything, and my horrible experience with his drinking, that I would never drink. That did not stop me from drinking, and it didn't stop me from, becoming an alcoholic. So that goes out to anybody who grew up in similar circumstances. I know there are many of us in AA who grew up that way, thinking that I'll never be that way. So anyway. And actually, that was a big part of my story, you know, both the fact that I did end up drinking, and then for a long time, like, this idea I was going to be better than that. I wanted to be better. You know, such shame and such judgment of alcohol throughout my entire drinking. And again, that's just my story as growing up that way. Not everybody had that story, but always, from before I ever took a drink, was a desire to control. You know, control somebody else's drinking and later to control my drinking. Anyway, like I said, I was in elementary school and my dad was a fall down drunk, and I decided that because my family was so shameful, I needed to look really good on the outside in order to get by. So I got good grades in school, you know, just was a real like teacher's pet, loved school, liked being at school better than being at home. You know, just really wanted to be like the perfect, wanted to be perfect, you know, and never wanted people to come over my house for fear of they'd see what my home life was like. And actually real grateful anytime somebody else's parent fell down on the ground, I was really grateful because I thought my dad was the only one. So, you know, I took relief in others' misery. So anyway, this idea of looking good on the outside. Now, in elementary school, my best friend, her sisters got real involved with drugs. You know, at like 13, 14, they got really involved with drugs. One had a suicide attempt. One had to go to rehab. The whole family had to go to psychological services. So here I saw a horrifying example of alcohol from my earliest recollections, horrifying examples of drugs. None of this stopped me from drinking and using drugs, and that being my story. But it's just interesting, and the reason I bring it up is because something that I had to get the painful way. I thought that having opinions about alcohol, negative opinions, and having a will to not be that way would stop me from being that way. And I had to learn the hard way that self-knowledge and willpower are not the things that keep a person sober. And I had to learn that, you know, and I'll get to that in my story. But I bring it up because, you know, I had examples. I knew what these things did, and it didn't stop me. So it isn't about knowledge and willpower. Anyway, like, right before going to junior high, I recall thinking to myself, oh my God, I don't want to go to junior high because of what I'd seen happen to these girls. They're going to make me use drugs there, you know? And instead of steering clear and hanging out with really nice people, or, you know, I had a best friend who never drank, never used, I went right to the crowd that was smoking pot, hanging out, ditching school, getting in trouble. The girl who I wanted, what she had, I wanted to be like her, lost her virginity, you know, went to rock concerts, drank alcohol, used drugs, and I wanted to be like her. So when you want what they have, you do what they do, you know. And we were hanging out, and I might have smoked pot before I drank alcohol. I don't remember because it wasn't, was never my drug of choice. But I do remember my first drink. And again, what is a coincidence, which I no longer think is a coincidence, is I was in seventh grade when I had my first drink. It was with a girl whose mom was a fall-on-the-floor drunk, and I liked that, you know, because I didn't have to be ashamed. But coincidentally, that year, my dad got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I was 12 or whatever, he came into the program. And now I think, you know, with all my opinions and judgments and fear of God of alcohol, I think there might have been some little connection in my brain. Now that my dad is sober, you know, now I can have a drink myself, you know, because I was a one stressed out kid worrying about his drinking, you know. And I don't know, they say in family dynamics and things like that, things that we learn in sobriety, that, you know, there's always, the whole family is sick. And so the problem sometimes just shifts from one to the other, whatever. So anyway, what I recall is he was already in the program. This, her mom was a fall down drunk, and I liked that. And this girl, one day we were at her house, and she said, "Do you want to get drunk?" And again, the reason I bring that up is because I had such an opinion of alcohol. And I didn't think, like, ooh, no, get that stuff away from me. Thank God, you know. Instead, I took, she poured us two, you know, probably a glass of vodka like that in a, you know, like a juice glass. And I took a sip, and it tasted horrible. And so what I did, either she taught me or I figured it out, is I held my nose. And I took another sip. And I kept drinking until I got about halfway through the glass. Now, I think a normal person, if it tasted horrible, would recoil as if from a hot flame, like our big book talks about. Like I do now. Now I can't even stand the smell of hard alcohol. It makes me want to retch. But then, you know, I just held my nose. So about halfway through the glass, I think I had the experience, and I, again, this is a program where we identify ourselves, which differentiates me from a normal or average or temperate drinker. I experienced a change of personality. I experienced a liberation from the bondage of self halfway through that glass of vodka, and really a complete change of personality. We were listening to The Doors, and all of a sudden, I was Jim Morrison, you know? I mean, I experienced every kind of transformation right there, including gender, right? I was, you know, I was the music, and all of a sudden, all those, I was just a ball of self-centered fear. What do people think of me? What do they think about me? Oh my God, what if they knew? What if they knew? You know, what it, all of a sudden, those voices, which were constant, ceased. And all of a sudden, it was like, what have I been so worried about? You know? My God, not only am I great, I'm better than these people I'm drinking with, you know? So I am somebody who drank not just to feel even, but to feel better than, you know. I like to get that ego on, you know, and to feel like it was doing for me what I could not do for myself. So I was literally, from my first experience of drinking, using it as a higher power, you know, trying, like, it was amazing to me that those voices could stop. I had no experience with being able to make those voices stop. And, you know, sometimes I feel for kids who grew up in similarly bad circumstances like mine. You know, like people want to help them or whatever. And it's like, if I could have made those voices stop by myself, I think I would have. But I just, you know, of myself, I didn't know how. So that's what we learn here in the program, just to fast forward. You know, there is a way out for us besides the liberation we do get from alcohol. But anyway, back then I didn't know it. So anyway, it was a school day. And my mom came to pick me up at this girl's house. And I had vomited. I had had a little blackout, you know, where first I was inside the house, then I was outside the house. I didn't remember going from inside to outside the house. I remember that the girls I was drinking with were laughing and must have thought I was either really entertaining or really making an ass out of myself, one or the other. Hard to tell the difference between the two. And I had vomited, like I said, and I got in the car and my mom said, "You're drunk." And for me, my own sad little story of teenage alcoholism was I was immediately ashamed of myself, you know, because I had all that stuff around my dad. And she might as well, for me, what I heard is, you're just like your father. I mean, she didn't say that, but that's what I heard. Like, that thing is so shameful. The word drunk was such a shameful word to me. So I just lied, just denied it, absolutely lied, said, no, I had a migraine headache, whatever. I just could not cop to it. So, and I would not cop to it. So her solution was to say, you can't hang out with that girl anymore. You know, figuring if she took away the friend, then I wouldn't do the behavior anymore. Well, of course I did. I lied. I still hung out with her. I still hung out with all the people, all the teenagers, like I said, that I was attracted to in junior high. Most all of them came from homes just like mine, either alcoholic or divorced or just some kind of thing that made us all the, you know, kind of like the messed up kids club, you know. And so I just hung out with these messed up kids, and my drinking was done primarily in parks, alleys, beaches, people's houses. You know, we procured our alcohol illegally. It was either stolen, taken from someone's parents, you know, and this was my personal story. So I was doing a lot of that stuff, 12, 13, 14. By the time I was 14, I have a clear memory of trying to control my drinking. Like I said, I drank in a lot of parks. And we drank with, it was me, I was, back then I was listening to, you know, punk rock music, hanging out with guys in bands or whatever, and we'd drink in the park, and I had a habit of, I'd drink, and I thought that I was very witty, and I would start, like, trying to make fun of guys, you know, make fun of people, and I just felt so in control when I was drunk. I don't know if anyone can relate, probably, if you're in this room, you know, like that whole better than thing. And one of the things that I didn't like is that I'd get drunk and I'd do this better than thing and then wind up pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized by the end of the evening and would recall with humiliation the next day, like, oh, how could I have done that if I could have just stopped at three beers? You know, for me, beer was my drink of choice. Never liked hard alcohol, even after the first time I drank it. Continued to drink hard alcohol throughout my drinking. Never really liked it. Continued to drink it. But beer was, you know, much more of my flavor. And at about three beers, I would feel that thing where my neck would loosen up and I'd just feel relaxed. And I think, oh, if I could just stay there. Well, like I'm recalling, I didn't just stay there. And I had the thought that maybe I just am better off not drinking at all, you know, because we have this metabolic allergy that once we start to drink, we can't stop drinking. Well, the experiment was so successful. You know, I maybe made it through a couple of weekends where everybody else was drinking and I wasn't, that I assumed, hey, I don't have a problem. I can't possibly have a problem. I just made it through the whole weekend not drinking. And one thing that I also did, because I continued to have judgments about alcohol, was I enjoyed those couple of times being sober because everybody else made such an ass out of themselves. You know, I enjoyed feeling like I was superior and they were making such asses out of themselves. And I felt so superior that, again, I determined I can't possibly have a problem. And I was like 12, 13, you know, 13 or 14 at that time. Well, fast forward to me, age 15, with having done these experiments of quitting for a period of time and starting again, usually within a couple of weeks or a couple of weekends or whatever. At age 15, my cousin turned me on to methamphetamine. And this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I share it because it was really, it was speed, and boy, it sped up my bottom, let me tell you. You know, I had just every kind of physical problem and all sorts of resulting trouble with it that it got me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, first at the age of 17. But anyway, what I did was, with my first experience of speed, if anybody has used drugs in here, is once again, I felt like I was relying on something to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And again, it was the same things that I had originally sought from alcohol, control. And even more control. You know, with speed, I felt like I was smarter than everybody. You know, I was more awake. I could drink a lot more alcohol, you know, and not necessarily black out, make an ass out of myself, do something that would be embarrassing or humiliating afterwards. And another thing is, at that same year, I had determined that I really wanted to go to college, so I was getting high and writing papers. I was getting high, and within, I don't know, within 3-6 months, I had discovered that I was a genius. I don't know if any of you, if there's any fellow stimulant users, but stimulants really unleash these latent powers of genius that I previously didn't know. I was like, my God, why didn't anybody tell me? You know? I immediately enrolled in all advanced placement courses, and I did really well, too. You know, I would get high, write papers. I was in AP Biology, AP English, AP Spanish. I'd get high, I'd write papers, and then I'd drink to come down and fall asleep at night. But again, for my story, it was all part of that try to look good, try to be better than, try to be superior, you know, have that control, use these drugs, this alcohol to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And the reliance became really intense in my year preceding getting into college because, you know, like I said, I had to do, you know, I'd had to use the speed to do the work, and I really thought that the speed was doing the work for me, you know? And then I had to drink to come down. I mean, it didn't matter. I could smoke pot, I could take sleeping pills, I could take Quaaludes. Nothing would shut me off the way alcohol did. And so it became like drinking more and harder alcohol in order to fall asleep and to get the racing mind to shut up. And again, just to reiterate, one of the things we hear in here, one of the first things I heard in the 12-step rooms that I loved and hung on to was insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. I really got that because, man, it got, for me, in my last 2 years of drinking and using, I would get high off speed. I'd do up a line, and then all of a sudden I'd immediately go, I've got to come down, I've got to come down, I've got to come down this, you know, and I'd just start drinking, smoking some pot, drinking, you know, it's just like, this person would be clearly insane, right? Like, why do the line in the first place, you know? So anyway, it was just an example of what I then related to when I got into these rooms, that is not sound and sane thinking, you know? Anyway, I did get into college, and the summer prior to going to college, my father caught my sister, a friend of mine, and I in my closet doing lines. He pulled us out of the closet, took my sister and I, stuck us in the car, and drove us to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. By that time, he had been a few years sober. He brought us to the room. My sister and I had to go inside. You know, we were scared or whatever. And unlike Mickey G, from my very first, and this was when I was 17, from the time I stepped in the room, I had gratitude, love, and awe of Alcoholics Anonymous. The gratitude was, I knew Jekyll and Hyde, flat on the floor, Dad could not have stopped. I already saw this program as like a miracle program because my dad didn't drink anymore. Second, I just loved the warmth in the room, the laughter in the room, the people in the room. In fact, the people seemed so good and clean and wholesome and fun and everything that I was afraid to touch their hands during the Lord's Prayer because I felt so dirty inside, you know, and so ashamed of myself. So I sat through the meeting and just tears were streaming down my face like, oh my God. And again, because I had guilt and judgment about alcohol before I ever took alcohol, I was somebody who would always make promises like, oh, I don't want to be like this. I didn't want to be like this. I didn't want to turn into my father. I didn't want to this. I didn't want to that. Oh, look at these people. So I put people in AA on a pedestal like, wow, you know, these people are sober and da 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 da. And we left the meeting and, you know, having really comprehended nothing other than the fact that the people in the room were sober that day and kind of wanting what they had but having no idea how to get it. When we got home, my dad said, I want you to get rid of all the drugs in your room, and I had just a little bit of speed left. And so when he said, go in the bathroom and flush it down the toilet, I looked at this little bit of speed in this vial and, you know, again, the insane thinking that characterizes me is I thought, well, man, it's only like $15 worth of speed, but hey, that's, you know, it's a good amount of speed. You know, I'll just do this little bit up and I'll stop tomorrow, you know? And thus began a summer of, just from that one choice, began a summer of attending meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, getting high before, drinking, getting high after, you know? But going to the meetings, wanting what people had, having not really an idea of how to get it, thinking that this place was about control, thinking this place was about guilt. You know, if I felt guilty enough, I'd stop. If I was ashamed of enough of myself, I'd stop. You know those resolutions we'd make in the morning? I remember those resolutions I'd make in the morning. I thought those resolutions would keep me sober, you know? And so again, it was just not really getting it, thinking it was about something other than, as this conference is called, letting go, absolutely. You know, I just didn't connect those dots. I didn't understand what steps were. I didn't understand really what this deal was. So I drink, hang out with other teenagers who are also going to Alcoholics Anonymous. We drink. For some reason, I like drinking with the kids of AA better, too, because I thought, well, at least we could all feel guilty together, you know? Or we could talk about the speaker while we're drinking in the park after the meeting, you know? And I really honestly did like this place. I thought AA was a glamorous place, an exciting place. Being in LA, I did see some celebrities. I heard, you know, I just thought it was like, hoo-hoo, you know, this neat place. And my dad had gotten sober. The stories were always funny to me. I really liked what it was. And I didn't get the program by osmosis. I really didn't get the program by sitting in the rooms, but I did hear the message. And I know that because, like I said, I kept using through that summer, and my mom and I drove up to Santa Cruz where I'd gotten into school. I had been on like a three-day speed binge before we got up there. Crazy as all get out, if anybody can relate from many days of stimulant use. You know, just bugging out, talking to my mom about every philosophy under the sun. I was always smarter then, you know? Really bugging out, hearing things, having a lot of auditory hallucinations. In fact, I heard the people in the room next door talking about me. Of course, they had never met me before. They didn't know who I was, but, you know, paranoid, larger than life, grandiose, it must be about me, you know? Made a decision that I'm going to go over to their, you know, opening college night party and get drunk and just show them how cool I am, you know? And I went over there, got drunk, and they did like me. They loved me. And one guy loved me so much, he took me off campus, and I got in a pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized situation, got locked out of my apartment. This guy turned out to be weird. I had to have security let me in. You know, I was classic for doing that, like, get drunk, think somebody's in love with me, start crying and telling them my whole life story, you know? They want to get rid of you quick after that, you know? So, you know, and then I didn't have keys, and security had to let me in, and I was so embarrassed and ashamed and all these things. And what I recall in that real teachable period we have in the morning when we're really pitifully, incomprehensibly demoralized, when the humiliation is fresh and we're very teachable, I remember recalling a line I had heard in AA, it gets worse and never better. And it stuck me. It hooked me. I felt like, bam, it's me. And I felt like, oh my God, God has seen me in those meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's on to me. I'm not getting away with it anymore, you know? It felt like the trouble's on, you know? I'm not going to get away with the things that I used to get away with. It gets worse, never better. It gets worse, never better. Oh, that's what those people from the meeting meant. So anyway, I didn't stop. I made a promise. Oh, I'm never going to drink again. I'm never going to drink again, which I promptly forgot within 2 weeks. You know, that was always my case. I didn't go to a meeting. I didn't make any kind of surrender. I would just try to guilt myself sober, try to shame myself sober, try to wish myself sober, and it never worked for me. So again, I continued to drink, I continued to use drugs to write papers, thinking it was making me smarter. I remember getting a paper back in the fall semester that I had written on acid, incidentally. I had thought this paper was quite brilliant, and it was returned like, this makes no sense at all. And my ego compensated by saying, oh my God, I've gotten so high in my thinking, I'm now at this genius level. They can't crack the code. I'm writing in a higher code now that only really genius people can catch on to. Obviously not this professor. Obviously not any of these TAs reading my work. You know, I'm operating on this real high. I don't need nouns and adjectives anymore, you know? I would just write in images. I would string images together, you know? And again, it was like, on the one hand, the ego would say, I'm brilliant, and on the other side was the fear, or I'm insane, you know? And I just would try to keep that fear quiet. And so again, I just kept drinking and using. Again, in the fall also of that year at Halloween, I took several hits of acid, not the one to write the paper, to celebrate Halloween. In my mind, now that I'm at college, I was gonna have this experience like I'd seen in movies. I really thought my life would be like Animal House or something, you know? Because somehow by being in college, it would remove all the horrible things that, you know, would happen, like getting drunk and making suicide threats. Somehow those would go away when I was around college kids and we were having fun, you know? And what happened is I took like 3 hits of acid or something, and instead of having like, whoo, colors, this is fun, instead my whole trip was, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic, you know? And it was like the buzzkill of a lifetime. I wish that none of you ever take acid after you've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was like taking a big sober pill, and it was like, what kind of creep am I? I went to meetings, I sat and listened to meetings, I make promises. Look at me, you know, what am I doing? Oh my God, I'm an alcoholic, you know? And I saw how I was like my father. I saw that the drinking was like this hypnotic, you know, like this hypnotized, you know, madman behavior, you know? Like I saw it so clearly. So that time, the next morning, when the resolve was fierce and the self-awareness was on, and this time I'm really going to stop. Now this time, I actually went down to the payphone, in dark clothing, you know, like hiding, very paranoid. Went down to the payphone, I called up my dad, and I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And I don't even know, but before that, I forgot. That night when I was high and under the influence, because I'd had this determination, like I'm an alcoholic, I went to the payphone and I called central office in Santa Cruz. Turned out that central office was somebody's house, you know. They answered the phone and I was like, I'm an alcoholic, you know. And he's like telling me where a meeting was in downtown Santa Cruz. And I'm like, where is that? And I was like trying to draw it on my hand, you know, because I couldn't connect where, like, how people actually got from one place to another, you know, like when I was that high, but the guilt was on, you know. So again, I didn't go that night, and I didn't even go the next day, but I called my dad. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic, and he sent me the big book. And, you know, when the big book arrived, whatever, however many days later, it was wrapped in plain paper. I was so grateful, because God forbid anybody know, you know. And I went up to my room, and I was, you know, not drunk at the time, and I read the big book. And I'm somebody who also not only loved AA from the first, loved the big book. Loved the big book, because thank God in that book there were people who thought like me. And one of the things that gave me such relief was the guy with the story with the whiskey and the milk. You know, I so understood that insanity. And I was like, there's somebody who thinks like me. And if you don't know it, you're going to have to read it to find that story. but anyway, I was highlighting. I was really getting into it. I was so into it. I didn't go to a meeting, but I was so into it that later when I got drunk, and I did get drunk, I took out the big book and I tried to 12-step my friends, you know? I was drunk and I was reading passages from the family afterward and going, don't you see, this is us. We're just like these people. We can't stop. We want to stop, but we can't. And they were like, we don't want to stop, you know? They too were trying to have their animal house experience, and I was the extreme buzzkill. It was like, get this girl out of the room, you know? They were just trying to have some fun, and it was like, no, we're not all feeling guilty and threatening suicide, Sabrina. That's just you, you know? Because I would do that. I'd get drunk, and I'd go, I want to die. Call suicide prevention, you know? I mean, I just couldn't control the behavior, you know? I wouldn't know what was going to happen when I started to drink. So anyway, like I said, they were like, out of the room, please. And so there was one guy who was also prone to depression. And he didn't get depressed when I would bring up how depressing everything was and how depressing we were and, you know, like how hopeless we were. And he'd say, do you really think, you know, that we're alcoholics, Sabrina? And, you know, here we were getting high, and I went doing up my line of crystal meth, and I'm like, yes, there is this place, it's called Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been there. The people are so good, and they know how to stop, and, you know, like, we can go there too, you know, come on, let's go. And, you know, he didn't want to go, but he listened, and he believed, and it's just like, you know, would that we could just get high and all hang out in a room and talk about how the 12 steps worked, because that was a fun program while I was working it. You know, it seemed to work at the time, like, just get high and talk about it. But again, I was missing that factor of letting go absolutely. I was missing the complete surrender. I was missing actually coming into the rooms. And a lot of it was I was missing the doing it by myself thing. I thought if my friends got sober, you know, if they felt as shitty as I do, then we could all come and get sober together. And just, you know, they didn't want what I had, and they didn't want to, plus I was trying to transmit what I hadn't got, you know. And they didn't want to do all this stuff I was saying that we had to do. But I would see, you know, where the meetings were in town, and I would walk on the other side of the street because I was afraid, because I was so, you know, again, my last year of using, that was my last year, was just haunted, truly haunted by knowing this program existed, really believing it worked, loving the good men and women, boys and girls, the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, and not feeling like I could get in the room. And so if I ever need a reminder on my first step and my powerlessness and how important my seat is to me and how I never want to lose my seat, all I have to recall is knowing that this place is the answer and feeling like it's impossible to get here. I'm here and I'm staying. I never want to leave. You know, I'm so grateful to not have to go through that hell over and over and over again. Drinking, making a promise, feeling guilty, making a promise, breaking the promise, drinking, feeling guilty, making the promise, breaking the promise. Because it's just that was my gates of insanity and death. You know, just over and over doing that. And then for me, again, because I said the speed brought up the physical problems, I thought I was having a heart attack just about every night. I'd lie there and I'd go, oh God, you know, please, if I just get through this night, I promise I won't use again. You know, there I'd be again. You know, two nights later, three nights later, oh, if I could just fall asleep. Oh, please just let me fall asleep. You know, I promise if I could just make it through this night alive, I won't do it anymore. You know, I would lie there like, you know, bargaining with death to let me live and let me not have a heart attack, you know, thinking if I did fall asleep, I was going to die, thinking if I didn't fall asleep, I was going to die. This was my gates of insanity and death, doing it over and over again, somehow expecting a different result, having reason lose out, the peculiar mental twist that our big book talks about, win out, not seeing, you know, not having the same thought beforehand and being right back in that position again. Begging God for my life, you know, bargaining with death, hoping this time, if I could just live this time, you know, I promise I won't do it again, and doing it again. And like I said, the school was not co-signing the theory of my genius like I'd hoped they were. So for me, my last year was just, I did pass my first year of college, but just things were not going the grandiose way that I had hoped for myself and saw for myself, the dreams I had always had for myself, the not wanting to be like my father trip that was my trip. And so that summer, I moved back to Los Angeles. My parents had divorced. My mom was in an apartment. I had to sleep on the couch. I mean, for me, this was just all, it was very depressing. It was a depressing time of life. Things not going the way I wanted, having all the physical, I had a lot of physical problems with the speed, not just the heart attack thing, but hair, my hair falling out, my teeth beginning to rot, you know, like stuff that your average 18-year-old is probably not dealing with, you know. The drinking, the insanity, the auditory hallucinations, which started to happen when I wasn't even using, you know, like, uh-oh, maybe I'm schizophrenic now, you know, just like that kind of stuff, like fear all the time, living in constant fear. Anyway, that friend, the guy who was the only one who could put up with me, called me. I guess it was in July. It was either July, it must have been July of 1987. And he was in a treatment center, Tarzana Rehabilitation Center, specifically in L.A., he had tried to kill himself with a combination of pills or whatever and had failed. So they put him in the drug and alcohol unit of this Tarzana Rehabilitation Center. And he invited me to come see him there. So I went to go see him there. You know, he had been this real good friend to me. And I went and he invited me for the AA meeting. Now, this was the first meeting I went to voluntarily since the summer before. You know, because I'd gone to a bunch of meetings during that summer, but it was because my dad made me. And I went into the room, and it was like in a little treatment center, and there was a little table, and there was a 12 and 12, and there were people in their robes, you know, like their little hospital gowns and stuff. And they passed around the 12 and 12, and it got to me, and I said, I'm Sabrina, I'm an alcoholic. And that was the first time I said that, you know, outside of a place where I was partying and trying to 12-step people, you know. I'm Sabrina, I'm an alcoholic. It was the first time I had actually entered a room, again, voluntarily since that summer previous. And that night, when I drank, because I didn't stop drinking just because I went to a meeting, something happened up here where all of a sudden, again, it was like the acid thing. I saw myself like, you were just sitting in a room today saying that you're an alcoholic, and now you're drinking again. And I connected like the schizophrenia of that, the schism, that I really saw that I was, my story, somebody who was going to, for an indefinite and God knows how long, infinite period of time, make promises, feel guilty, feel terrible about myself, say I want to get sober, talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, read the big book, I would maybe even go to a meeting or two, and I would not stop drinking. I realized by myself, with this program of will and knowledge and guilt and shame and wanting it and talking about it and thinking about it and getting high and talking about it, I would just do it over and over and over and over, and that was my fate. And it would get worse and never better. And I connected that the first half of the first step, you know, I am powerless over alcohol. This is what I will do. This is the dance I do with alcohol. For me, I didn't even get the trouble-free, rebellious, aha, F you, I'm an alcoholic, who cares? I had the guilt, shame, oh my God, I want to stop. I had made so many resolutions I had signed literally in blood. Like I'd prick my finger, sign in blood, didn't get me sober, you know? And I saw that that's my program. When I work the program by myself, this is what I get. And I connected, oh my God, I can't do this. You know, just like Mickey G was talking about, I can't do it by myself. And out of fear, sheer fear, and a real, like, you know, kind of a blinders being lifted that this is my program and this is what I will do by myself over and over again, I got out the white pages, and it must have been, I guess it was, whenever I got the white pages out was like August 3rd or whatever. And I called in the white pages, it just said Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called up and I said, where's a meeting near my house? And they told me where a meeting was near my house. The next day, I went to my first voluntary by myself Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. That was August 4th of 1987. And I have been sober since. Thanks. I got in there, and I think for me, my first step was all of those efforts to do it my way. Even all of those efforts to think, you know, like I keep, it's my story, but shame, guilt, reading a big book, wanting to go to meetings or going to meetings, getting high and talking about meetings, all those things that I did by myself, I was really absolutely sure they weren't going to work. So in that respect, I let go absolutely. And I came in willing, just like Mickey G said, to do it somebody else's way, you know. Like, because I just knew my program wasn't working. So what I did in the first 30 days, I didn't get a sponsor in my first meeting. I raised my hand, and I just raised my hand like the first 30 days, took a chip, got, you know, had that big book, read the big book with a highlighter, found myself in the big book, was so relieved to find things. Italicized in the big book, self-knowledge will not fix it, you know. There will come a time when we'll have no defense against a drink. Our defense must come from a higher power. This is a point we wish to smash home to the reader. And I went, that's what's been the thing all along. I really thought maybe I'm just insane. But before I thought maybe I'm just insane, I thought, oh, maybe my willpower is just not strong enough. Ooh, if I could just try harder. Ooh, if I could just know more, you know, if I had more self-knowledge, more self-awareness. It was so great that the big book said self-knowledge will not fix it. There will come a time when we have absolutely no defense against a drink. Our defense must come from a higher power. So this is where I got, beside the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, inklings, hearing about this thing that was the actual thing that was going to, you know, help me get sober, this higher power that I would come to know through the 12 step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, you know. I had a spiritual awakening that to this day is the thing that keeps me from the insane cycle, drink, guilt, resolution, drink, guilt, resolution, drink, guilt, resolution. Because of the experience I've had with this higher power, I never have to go into that tornado again. And I never want to go into that tornado again. So anyway, I didn't know that the first day I walked in. I just knew my program wasn't working. Then in about 30 days, I said to my dad, how do you do this deal? And he said, find somebody with 15 or more years of sobriety who has a spiritual program and not a psychological program. My home group was the Alano Club in West LA, and my home group throughout my sobriety has mostly been in like clubhouse AA. There was a woman who had 25 years of sobriety who had a spiritual program, and primarily the thing that attracted me to her is that I wanted what she had, because there is so much to do at the beginning of this deal, you know. Being a young person, being an old person, being in any person, there's so much that goes into the surrender that I think it's so important to pick somebody who you really want what they have so that you're willing to do the deal, you know, and willing to listen to somebody and willing to want what they have when you don't think it's going to work for you, you know, to go, oh, maybe if it worked for them, maybe it could work for me too, you know. Maybe if she believes in God, I can believe in her God until I can believe in my own God. And that really worked for me. I asked her to take me through the steps. And this is how I, quick rundown of how I understand the steps today. And like I said, that was my first, well, I guess that was my first sobriety, even though I'd attended meetings, you know, the summer before. This was when I first voluntarily came in. How I understand the first step now is my body metabolizes alcohol different from a normal person. There is no judgment in that. There's no shame in that. No more shame than if I were a diabetic and couldn't metabolize sugar like a normal person. So I have no judgment on the fact that I can't metabolize it. And nor, thank God, to this day, do I entertain the idea that somehow, some way, I will be able to control and enjoy my drinking. I have, you know, I have let go absolutely of that belief, you know. And I accept that I metabolize alcohol differently, and I don't even want to metabolize it like a normal person at this stage in the game. What has kept me in the rooms and what is the daily surrender is the second half of the first step. And my life, you know, we were powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. And my life is still unmanageable by me. I believe that the whole deal in here is that I come into a power greater than myself that will solve all my problems, you know, and then I have to, you know, turn all things over, as the big book says, to the Father of Light who presides over us all. And that's a daily deal for me, sometimes a minutely deal for me, sometimes an hourly deal, sometimes a second-by-second deal for me. And I believe that this program delivers on that promise time and time and time again. And seconds lead to minutes, lead to hours, lead to days, lead to, you know, 19 years and however many hours before 20 tomorrow, you know? And thank God. And not doing things on my program anymore, you know, again, just like Mickey G said, there's a lot of vinegar to get through. But, you know, day by day by day by day, it gets better. It gets, at least it's not, it gets worse. Well, there's been times when it gets worse. But then it gets better and it gets better and it gets better and it gets better. And the primary thing that is so great about getting some time in this program is seeing these solutions work. These solutions work. I had a problem 2 weeks ago, cried, wrote a 10th step, got to the other side. There's peace, you know. I have sponsored people, seen them get sober, put years together, just had a sponsee celebrate 10 years. You know, I can see it works. I can see it works out there when I can't see it works here, you know. That's the gift of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can see myself go through inventory and get to another side and change behavior and have new experiences and have my life grow and change. So it's the faith that we get from seeing this deal in ourselves, in our lives, and in the fellowship. So the first step, second step, believing this power greater than myself would restore me to sanity, and believing it in my sponsor when I couldn't believe it in me. And let me try to wind this up. Third step, making that third step prayer with my sponsor, and I felt a power flow in, and I felt something transform in me. And I believe that's the thing that keeps me from the insane cycle over and over again. Taking that inventory, having her help me take that inventory and really make it clear to me, selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my troubles. Not these old men who wrote the big book. My troubles today, you know, I have to do this deal as intensely as they did the deal. Just because I was 18 and this nice college girl doesn't mean I don't have to do the same rigorous program of honesty and, you know, all the things that they had to do. Self-searching, leveling of our pride that it talks about. You know, making those amends, six and seven, making the amends. And 10, 11, and 12 is what I've continued to live in throughout my sobriety. I've done steps all the way through many times, but I continue to live in steps 10, 11, and 12. Before 10 years, I thought I was going crazy. You know, I went through the steps again there. I've gone through the steps. My dad died when I was 13 years sober, went through the steps again then, went through the steps just again this year. Met my husband at Alcoholics Anonymous, speaking at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I asked him out. We've been together ever since, you know. So I've found my whole life here. And then just to wind it up, you know, again, just it's the daily renewal of the spiritual program, the daily surrender to the higher power. And how I like to look at steps 10, 11, and 12, especially when I'm working with sponsees, is 10, 11, and 12 are out of self, out of self, out of self. You know, take the inventory to get out of self, pray and meditate to get out of self, and then that magical 12th step, it works when all other activities fail, working with others, carrying the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, you know.
And they're all to get me out of myself, out of myself, out of myself, where the solution is, where God is. And I do a lot. I do daily meditation, and I, you know, practice my 12-step by doing the steps and by sponsoring people and by attending meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been an ever-unfolding, rich gift. I've had a lot of creativity. I've been in a band since, a number of years of my sobriety, got into art and acting and writing and film and all these things in sobriety. So it's just like you never know what's going to happen, and it just unfolds, 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 gets better, and I think I'm like winding up on my time. Is that correct? Oh, here I was fast forwarding, thinking that I had nothing left to, that I had talked too long. Anyway, what I would like to just say is, my sponsor suggested I get a job. Isn't that good? Sponsor suggesting we get jobs. Sponsor suggested I get a job after college, and it was teaching. And I took her suggestion, and I've been teaching for, 13 years or 14 years at the same school, the same, a lot of the same people. So again, one of my pitches for 10, 11, and 12, like I said, I've been teaching at the same school for a number of years. I was in a band. I've been in a band with one person and a few people for many, many years. I've had a relationship with my family in sobriety for my whole sobriety, which is unique. Not everybody, you know, likes to stay with their family of origin or keep relationship with them in sobriety. And now I've got a married relationship, and it's 10, 11, and 12. You know, I have to continue to take inventory and look at my part. Or I'm not somebody, even in sobriety, who's much fun to hang out with. Because my nature still, that's why it's so good my first sponsor taught me that thing about selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of my problems. What comes natural to me is to think I'm right and you're wrong, you know. My way must be better, you know. So I need these steps to sort of correct me and make me somebody who's able to get along with people. I don't write a 10th step every day. I don't even remember to ask myself those questions from the big book every day. I like to do the one in the morning where it says, upon awakening, we think about the 24 hours ahead before we begin. We ask God to direct our thinking. I remember that one every day. I'm also somebody, I've heard people in AA talk about using the seven sins as their defects of character. I'm using that in the mornings now. I've got this whole sheet on two sides from the last inventory I did, which was in spring, that my sponsor and I came up with all my defects and my living amends, and I have them on a piece of paper, and I go over them every morning. And each morning I ask God to protect me from not only selfishness, dishonesty, and self-seeking, but my big of the seven sins, pride, greed, and gluttony, and envy. On a daily basis, pride, greed, and envy will get me pretty much on a daily basis. So it's so good that I'm asking God not only to guard me against those things, but then I'm on the lookout, and then I see when they happen, you know, and I'm like, oh. And I use 10 steps from the big book when it gets so bad that it makes me cry, you know. Like, sometimes my envy issues will get so bad that I'll just start crying because I think my life isn't this great gift that it is. So I use the format in the big book of how to write an inventory, and I just do it that way with the 10th step, and then I ask God to remove my fear and help me to be as God would have me be, and it helps me get out of myself, like I believe steps 10, 11, and 12 want me to. I start the morning with like at least 5 minutes of meditation, and that I'll usually have that peace. Sometimes I can walk away from that peace and just go right into chaos. Other times, like today, I've been able to have that peace for several hours at a time, and that will be the case sometimes too. And then, you know, the 12th step is just continuing to work these steps and carry the message. So that has been my experience. I don't know that I have much more else to say. I use a lot of those books. I use AA literature, and I use also outside literature. My husband and I, we pray in the mornings together. If either one of us starts the day like, oh my gosh, this or that, we just grab hands and we start praying. I have a sponsor also in Al-Anon and my AA sponsor that I call when I need to, you know, anytime I need to. I have sponsees, some call me every day. Others just call me when they need me. And it gets better, you know? Like I said, I got one sponsee who has 10 years. Another sponsee who got sober at 16. She's got 9 years. I've got a cut. For a while, I was not working with people, and I noticed how crazy I was getting, and I prayed for sponsees, and I got some. I got like 3 people who were going to meetings, you know, who had some time already, but, you know, asked me to sponsor them, and that was a great answer to prayer. And then just trying to be of service to get out of myself. So anyway, I hope I didn't short you guys. I know I say a lot in a short period of time, so maybe I actually said as much as I would have if I had used the whole time because I talk so fast. Leftover damage from previous stimulant use, I'm sure. So anyway, I hope I'm not leaving you high and dry. Or I hope I am. No, wait. Yeah. Whatever. High and dry. The best way to be, right? And I guess I'll also say that I have known greater highs in this program than I ever knew from drugs and alcohol from this spiritual way of living. You know, I'm sure you guys have experienced it also, the release, the joy, the camaraderie, all the things that the Big Book promises. I don't experience them all on a daily basis, just like Mickey was talking about, not rainbows and roses on a daily basis, but when they're good, they're good. And I really like to remember that and hang on to that. I write about that in my journal so that I will remember that because I don't want to forget the gift that this program is. So I hope that I have brought you some joy, experience, strength, and hope, and I wish you a lovely convention, and thank you for listening to me and sharing this sober birthday with me. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.